then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's December the 17th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to talk about Margaret Sanger as the pivot of civilization. Written in 1919, this book is approximately contemporary to Sinclair's Jungle. Now, Margaret Sanger started her career leaning towards socialism, looking to solutions in politics and law, but personal experience led her to believe that biological concerns really drive society. Now, in this work, Sanger criticizes and champions various concepts. To a certain degree, I'm sure that Marxism was viewed by Sanger as a brave effort, but a superficial understanding of human nature. Marxism as a strategy desired to portray the proletariat as blameless and capitalists as evil. Sanger, in this book, takes on a slightly more nuanced view, arguing that the proletariat breed more or less according to the availability of factory jobs. And she states that uncontrolled breeding was fertile ground for predatory capitalism. Now, on the other side of the coin, there were some revolutionary Marxists who hoped for a larger population because they wanted more party members and unionists and hoped one day that these individuals would engage in worldwide revolution. However, many proletariat members wanted smaller families. In this work, Sanger argues that eugenics is the antithesis of socialism, in that eugenics stresses nature over nurture, whereas socialism is the reverse. Some may believe that Sanger was a patron saint of eugenics. In this work, Sanger exhibits concern about the reproduction of the feeble-minded, even hoping that they might be sterilized if the law allowed. But this writing is very hazy as to what extent these issues are environmental and to what extent they really are hereditary. Sanger has some criticism for eugenicists. She fears that most eugenicists are more talk than action, and also that they fail to help the less fortunate reproduce less, and that in their propaganda, they promote unrealistically high birth rates for the fit, which, if enacted, and I don't really know how often they were enacted, but at any rate, if enacted, they would lead to competitive childbearing. Now, to Sanger, at least in this work, She seems to express a belief that too many children is always a dysgenic event. Now, this belief is never explained because if parents are fit and can accommodate a large family, what would be unfit about that? And she never really explains that point. Now, this brings us to another important concept in this work, and that is Neo-Malthusianism. Malthus was an English writer who feared doom from overpopulation. And indeed, this subject is brought up so much that it would seem that, at least in this work, it is of an even greater concern than eugenics. Marx and other socialists were suspicious of the ideas of Malthus because they saw him as an aristocrat with class motives. Another concern voiced by Sanger in this work is a gentle critique of charities who, in a desire to give aid, increase the fertility of individuals who, according to Sanger, should not breed. In this work, which was written in 1919, Sanger is mainly concerned with lower classes of what I would presume are white workers. The work does not get into other various racial and ethnic groups and the dangers of miscegenation, which seems to be something of a glaring void in this work. Now, the term race is used from time to time, but it seems to be, at least in my interpretation, a general term for the human race. Margaret Sanger does speak of the international situation to a small degree, and she does bemoan the need for the victors to support the vanquished, because, of course, this is right after the First World War. Now, Sanger was arrested 8 times during her long career in eugenics. She's cited, of course, as you might expect, for a decline of public morals, especially by the National Council for Catholic Women. They argued that her campaign would, for one thing, degrade marriage, making it pleasure-centered rather than parenthood-focused, that it would tend to weaken self-control and cultivate a desire for ease and luxury, and that eventually there would be a population decline, and that also there would be a lowering of general morality. Now, Sanger believed that abstinence and self-denial were unobtainable ideals, and at the end of this book, Sanger writes, what she seeks is not only a matter of population control, but is a quest for inner peace and security that would come about by a middle way between libertinism and asceticism. She wants a world of small families with well-cared-for children. She believed that this would bring about a renaissance in arts and sciences. I do have to admit that the last few pages of this book have a certain candor or a certain style that would raise eyebrows in 1919. Even now, I would say, for my taste, sound rather out of place. If you would read the last couple pages of this book, I'm sure you would agree that after reading it, you might be led to wonder where this interest in eugenics and population control really stems from. At any rate, when you look at Sanger's career in a more general sense, it's clear that she did have a continued interest in eugenics. In 1926, Sanger addressed the women's section of a Klan meeting where she discussed birth control education, and she was one of the first to use that term, and also the question of eugenics. In 1939, she wrote to Clarence Gable. Now, this is a paraphrase. This is a rather cleaned up paraphrase, that she hoped that population control would reduce the genetic competition between Europeans and sub-Saharan Africans in favor of Europeans. There was an online article that did state that today 79% of Planned Parenthood clinics are within walking distance of various diverse neighborhoods. For good or ill, this rather adult version of Hearts and Flowers that she speaks of in this book has not created the earthly paradise that she had hoped. It is well possible that Sanger's ideas would work best with European and Northeast Asians, but Sanger never considers if other races or other people of different backgrounds would really understand and take her advice in the way that she would have had it. She tends to assume in this work that everyone will take on her essentially WASP values and assumptions. Granted, given her background of seeing very large families and the difficulties that may pose, especially for the impoverished, it's understandable that she would prefer small families, and she did evidently see poverty. This is an interesting study in a somewhat utopian ideology that we did see at the turn of the century. Its effects, both good and ill, that it has had, the various objections that people had to it, which seem to be more and more credible, but also the good effects, at least in terms of some reduction of various populations that really do need to be in check. So I hope you found this review interesting, and I thank you for listening, and have a good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
A few weeks ago, I mentioned that there has been a slight but perceptible downturn in the number of hits on our NorthwestFront.org website, which presumably corresponds to a lower listenership to this program. With some study of the stats, I can, to a limited degree, date this downturn from the late summer. One possibility is that a number of listeners have been frightened away by the Dylann Roof incident. Now, I don't know what to do about that because I have to tell you guys it's going to happen again. So long as the policies of the American dictatorship remain unchanged and the Democrats force us to live in this sewer surrounded by people who don't speak our language and who do not belong here, so long as mobs of screaming niggers seem to be able to dictate who is the president of what university and what police chiefs get to keep their jobs, and so long as young white people have no future in our own land, there are millions of potential Dylann Roofs out there. We need to accept that even among a people as cowed and intimidated and beaten down as white Americans, there are going to be occasional outbursts like this. There's an old saying that if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. The American political and racial kitchen is going to keep on getting hotter and hotter. You can count on it. However, there is another possibility that might account for the minor downward bump in listenership, and that is the allure of Donald Trump. Now, this is not unexpected. Someone like Trump appearing on the scene was a historical inevitability. Basically, people now have some place to go besides Radio Free Northwest for their racial entertainment, and some of you are wandering off into Trumple land. It was always on the cards that at some point someone would figure out that speaking out loud what the majority of the European-descended people of this country feel in their hearts and see all around them every day was a way to butter his bread and feed his ego, if nothing else. This person would pretty much have to be independently wealthy and have some kind of media bulletproofing, meaning that he couldn't be silenced or shouted down or simply shut out and ignored because he came from the world of celebrity, including politics, and he already had a sufficiently high profile so that he couldn't be flushed down the Orwellian memory hole. I always kind of figured it would be some southern congressman trying to make a name for himself, kind of a modern-day Huey Long, or else that somebody like Mel Gibson, who stepped out of line and was blatantly turned on and savaged by the same world he once commanded, would seek revenge. But it looks like the first of these self-serving would-be rock stars who have decided to capitalize on white rage and fear is the Donald. Now, I get it. I've already said that I don't mind if some of you guys go off and have a fling with Donald Trump. A white male candidate who speaks the truth, or some of it anyway, is such a rarity that I expect a few oohs and ahs from white nationalists. No sweat. But I feel compelled to repeat a warning that I have given several times before. Don't expect too much. One way or another, Trump is either going to betray us, most likely by doing something really outrageously pro-black, or else he is going to be taken out by the system, either through vote fraud or because as a last desperate measure, he's at a rally one day around April or May sometime, and a funny little man with a gun in his hand steps out of the crowd a la Arthur Bremer. I am convinced that Trump will not be the nominee. I very much hope he will be, because wouldn't that be something, watching him go up against the Hildebeest, eh? It would tear the two-party system apart, and that can only be a good thing. But I still just don't believe it's going to be allowed to get that far, and yes, I know that sounds all very conspiratorial. Look, I have never denied that conspiracies exist, especially in the upper echelons of the establishment and the power elite. I just don't think we need to use them as an excuse to do nothing on the grounds that the enemy is this single, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful monolith. That's just not true. And resistance is not just morally justified, but it's also possible. Right, now for some emails. This one is from Phil in Oregon, and the header is, quote-unquote, "Those guys in those groups are all FBI agents." Dear Mr. Covington, I've run into a number of people recently who, while at least somewhat aware of the problems our folk face, are unwilling to join any sort of group effort to fix things, mostly because of the sentiment expressed in the subject line. I'm looking for suggestions on the best way to counter this argument. I have reiterated the NF's policy regarding not admitting anyone who has ever collaborated with the enemy, but as you've said, there's no guarantee that the NF is informer free. I'm hearing a lot more folks starting to speak up now after what happened in Paris and the recent monkey shines in higher education. It's not so much waking up people as convincing them to get out of bed, get dressed, and go to work instead of either hitting the snooze button or spazzing out, grabbing the 45 out of their nightstand drawer and doing something they shouldn't. Signed, Phil. Okay, first off, whoever said that to you has a certain amount of truth on his side. Yes, some of the people involved with white nationalist groups are indeed police or federal informants of some kind, some groups more than others, although they prefer to use hired hands, assets they're called, rather than actual badge-carrying agents. I think they got twitchy about that since the Bernard Butkovich thing came out after Greensboro. My understanding is that the Bureau recruits hundreds of snitches all over the country, maybe even thousands, for a cash salary of $400 per week, plus immunity from most petty crime, for example, the marijuana grow-op that they caught the wretched Dave Uspeth on. I think they also get bonuses and piecework rates for tips regarding criminal activity, although needless to say, the FBI's definition of criminal activity is sufficiently broad to include about anything. A large part of these tips are either the informer simply making something up to satisfy his bosses and keep on collecting those 400 taxpayer simoleons every week, or else what they do is they get drunk with targeted individuals and report back on the drunk talk, which our friends in the silk suits then fabricate into a conspiracy along with a few planted plastic jugs of common household chemicals or some fabricated audio files. A good example of using the informer to incite and entrap people into breaking the law would be the loathsome Hal Turner, except that Hal entrapped himself. He overestimated the degree of liberty he was allowed by his handlers in pissing off the rich and the powerful. The FBI is now almost completely a domestic spying and political enforcement agency, despite occasionally going out on spectacular media spectacle-type raids, wherein they generally take the credit for other agencies' work and risk. Real crime prevention, and the arrest of for-real bad guys like drug dealers, is generally handled by either more specialized federal agencies, such as the DEA, Customs, and the ATF, or else by the local police. For example, I understand that the Texas Rangers have a crack drug squad, and they're just about the only American law enforcement who command any respect or fear at all from the Mexican drug cartels. The cartels consider the DEA and the FBI to be a joke. Well, they are. Few such federally targeted groups are actual criminals of any kind. Judging just from the news stories I see about FBI cases, I'd say that probably at least 50% of Bureau infiltration and surveillance ops are politically motivated. More if you count the infiltration of Muslim groups as political, although more and more, as we see from San Bernardino, these may also involve confrontation with bona fide jihadists who will actually open fire or detonate something. Virtually every mosque in the country has a couple of these $400-a-week men as members, as well as every group that rants and raves on Facebook about being sovereign citizens. Now, for some reason, over the past couple of years, the FBI has gone batshit over the sovereign citizen movement, although the ones I've met have been completely harmless eccentrics at worst. These $400 per week men, and sometimes women, seldom actually end up testifying in criminal cases because they're just too off the wall to withstand close scrutiny or cross-examination even by a second-year law student. As a rule, they do not impress juries, unless you got a jury full of niggers and liberals who would convict Abraham Lincoln if some U.S. attorney called him racist, which is basically what happened to Bill White. One good example was the sole witness who testified against Bill White in Florida during his last trial, a woman who admitted that not only was she a drug addict, but she was high at the time that she was testifying on narcotics, which had been provided to her that morning by the U.S. Marshals, no less. Anyway, Phil, getting back to the assertion that, quote-unquote, all of us are FBI agents, what can I tell you? I know for a fact that we've had a few like Usbeth nosing around and some others I won't name. A few years ago, we also had a man who genuinely was caught up in a nightmare situation where a close family member was in the grip of the system and the only hope for getting any mercy for the kid at all was for this man to turn on us, which he agreed to do. And then the first thing he did was to call me up and tell me all about it and warn all of us to stay away from him because he couldn't tell the Bureau anything he didn't know. We don't actually break the law. And what's more, our NF people as a rule don't engage in what you might call risky behaviors like hanging around and drinking in bars or casual drug use or other lifestyles that might lead to finding themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. Staying sober and not breaking the law is no guarantee you won't get pulled into the mangling machine. Ask Ed Steele or Bill White or Matt Hale or Johnny Logan Spencer, but it does help. Beyond that, I really don't know what to tell you, Phil. There are certain protocols and practices that I use to try and keep suspect people away from any one of us that they might do harm to. For obvious reasons, I won't discuss that anymore here. But at some point, you have to just accept that you've done all you can. And it's time to stop allowing these reptiles to force you to live in fear and stop you from exercising your rights as an American, old definition, and as a human being. Like the old saying goes, Phil, illegitimae non carborundum. Don't let the bastards wear you down.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. I think time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Children, what's that sound?
Okay, I know I promised I was going to get more serious on this program, more political, more big picture stuff and so forth, but I'm sorry. This is cute and I just can't resist dropping it in here.
Are you tired of diets that don't fill you up and leave you fatter than when you started?
Yeah.
Fed up with exercise equipment that you use once then leave on the curb? Or quick fix self-help books that fail to address the underlying problems at the core of your behavior? Well, now, there's a quick and easy way to live better, stay healthy, and have even more peace of mind.
Can you tell me more?
I'm going to. Scientists and other experts have developed a space-age solution used by millions of successful people around the world.
How long before you tell us what it is?
It costs nothing, and you can do it right now. And if you do it now, it's absolutely free.
What the fuck is it?
It's called Thinking for Yourself.
How's it work?
First, get some information.
Okay.
Consider what you've heard.
Right.
Then, come to your own conclusions based on the information provided.
Maybe I shouldn't eat all of these cupcakes. Wow, it works.
I work for a corporation. Can I think for myself?
You can try. Thinking for yourself works in virtually every situation. In school.
Maybe it is more than 6,000 years old.
At the office.
I don't think we should put condos here.
It's so easy. Even intellectuals can do it.
Chomsky sucks. He totally sucks.
Yes, thinking for yourself works for just about anyone. Just ask this hipster.
I used to hide my true feelings under a veil of irony. But let's face it, Neil Diamond rocks.
And if you act now, you'll get common sense and instinct absolutely free.
Why don't I just wear this sweater? It doesn't make sense.
I am going back to Jazzercise. I was happy there.
Not available in some states. Thinking for yourself may cause animosity and loss of companionship. Not compatible with some social groups, religions, and education systems. Thinking for yourself.
Greetings from Seattle. This is Andy Donner. I wanted to address the issue of converting the locals, which is periodically put to the party. I don't want this to turn into a case of spaced repetition, though, since that sort of thing is probably going to grate on long-term listeners. That, and the actual issue of converting the locals, doesn't really get us very far, so it's actually better to deal with this subject in terms of why the party, at the current time, pushes migration over everything else, since the reasons for our stances on both subjects are the same. As I said, this suggestion is periodically put to the party, and usually with a certain amount of confusion about why we're not doing it. As it happens, this directly ties in with the ever-present problem of the media blackout, but that's not what I'm here to talk about today, so I'll leave this thought with the observation that there are actually a number of strategies available to us, and a few different options are being worked. The rub, though, and the real reason we're pushing migration, is that we don't have the physical assistance we need to actually wrap them up. You know, that whole breaking out of the bubble thing recently discussed, which, of course, brings me back to the issue at hand, which seems to be some sort of inevitable spaced repetition which has already gone on in RFN's recent past. Okay, so the idea goes like this. Instead of needing to cause quite a few of you out there to actually suck it up and come home to the Pacific Northwest, we're actually supposed to convert the locals so that there's something for the rest of you to come home to. Putting off dealing with the real trouble with this notion, I have to make a couple of amusing observations to get you all in the thinking mood. Firstly, if we were able, through whatever process, to convert the locals, we wouldn't need to bug you guys at all. All of you ass-sitters out there that promise you'll come up here when we get something going, we'll find, when that comes to pass, we're not so interested in you anymore. Secondly, the issue of converting the locals almost always comes from the crowd asking us why there isn't more action. The problem is that the why isn't there more action crowd is very nearly the same thing as the segment of the pro-NF portion of the white nationalist movement which, quite vocally, refuses to come home themselves. Throughout my appearances on Radio Free Northwest, I've tried at least a dozen different ways of exploring this idea with all of you, but I can't seem to make any sort of progress in getting traction on it. At the very least, it's intellectually dishonest to wonder why there's no mass movement on the one hand while absolutely refusing to come home on the other. This attitude boils down to one of, this seems so important to me that I hope other people take care of it so I don't have to. Really, guys? I mean, really? And with those points out of the way, I'll get down to the real reason the party pushes migration first and foremost over anything else at the moment. To make this clear, let's all do a little imagining together, shall we? Okay, so through one means or another, the party manages to bust out of the bubble, as well as make it through the media blackout. How is irrelevant? And then does what with the people we convert? Be aware, I'm not going anywhere near what convert means, since I suspect it's something akin to the waking people up canard. So let's all just pretend, for the purposes of discussion, it actually means something. So back to the question. What, then, do we do with all of our brand new converts? The next step in this process is necessarily convincing all of these newly hatched white nationalists that they need to get on board with the Northwest Imperative to the point where they willingly inconvenience themselves for the good of the party. After all, white nationalism itself is some sort of drug we all need a hit of every now and then, but actual political activity isn't usually entertaining, and in reality, is almost always downright boring. The day in and day out of this sort of a colonial revolutionary process is not remotely entertaining, and requires something other than immediate self-interest or even hobbyism to maintain. Huh. This feels familiar. What other problem does the party have which is exactly like this? I can't quite seem to put my finger on it. Okay, look. Jokes aside here, the actual problem the party needs to deal with is how to coax specific behaviors from people when said behaviors aren't always of immediate benefit to them personally, and might actually detract from things they would rather do. One would think political and racial ideology would suffice, but it clearly doesn't. So it's actually in everyone's immediate benefit if we all try to figure out what would motivate the correct actions on the part of those who claim to share our beliefs. It's less work to make that happen than it is to try and turn someone to our ideology only to end up with the same problem we have right now with the current RFN audience. And even more important, we need the process of Northwest independence to be managed by people who aren't total noobs to the subject of racial nationalism and separatism. Official party literature correctly specifies our requirement of the better elements of the racially conscious community, rather than ragtag recently racist converts, as lovable as those people can be. Migration instills the sort of dedication and focus we need from party associates, which would otherwise take an utterly massive drive on our part locally. So here's the deal, guys. Lately, Harold and I have asked for your help in certain ways, and this could be another good opportunity for quite a few of you to contribute to the Northwest Imperative. We need to know what actually gets someone ginned up enough to dedicate themselves to the Northwest Independence Movement and the Butler Plan, since, one way or another, we have to figure out how to mass produce and distribute whatever that is. A note on this, though. I'm not interested in your theory craft about why the bulk of people act one way or another, or how it is that large-scale forces in the world influence the white population as a whole. That discussion has been had, and it's been had to death. Just like RFN is being refocused on actual politics, I'm trying to refocus the discussion around Northwest migration to something with an actual point, rather than vague observations about what people in general are likely to do. Right now, we're not trying to get through to people in general. Rather, we're trying to get through to a very specific type of person to change a very specific type of behavior. We're going for specific aspects of specific people, not generalities. Those generalities, by the by, are the sort of thing you all fall back on when you're looking for something to babble about, rather than face whatever it is about yourselves which is keeping you from committing. Reply to the party's request for assistance all you like. No, really, I mean that, because we genuinely need the input, but we're no longer going to tolerate useless general observations which are merely a smokescreen for the sort of individual avoidance of responsibility we've addressed in the past. That sort of avoidance is at the root of white cuctionalist thought, and if nothing else, I'm putting my foot down on that sort of thing going forward. Not too long ago, the Herald ended an RFN episode by asking what was wanted of the party. The meaning of this question went right over everyone's head, and the actual intent was to request feedback on what the party could actually say or do, which would cause commitment and participation on the part of the current audience. I'm more or less asking the same thing right now, but in a more pointed way, which I hope eliminates the possibility of willful refusal to understand. Hail victory.
Right, guys. Looks like this episode this week is turning into another race with my dying hard drive. I will try to get this episode uploaded, possibly a somewhat shorter episode than usual, and then my computer is scheduled for the cyber equivalent of open heart surgery, and will hopefully be up and functioning and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed next week, but we'll see how that plays out. Right, some more reader email. This is from one of our comrades here in the homeland itself. Greetings, Harold. This may sound like a joke at first, but please bear with me. I've just learned my family, half-brother and son, believe in interracial marriage. I falsely assumed, since they all very much believe fundamental Baptist theology, that they would be against it. I was dead wrong. My brother would allow his beautiful daughters to marry a wretched subhuman nigger, with the caveat that he is a quote-unquote saved wretched subhuman nigger. I'm at a loss. Plans were made to visit them over the holidays. I've told him our relationship has changed, and I could never support that. He said he's okay with my convictions and took the high road. I immediately wrote my son and asked him, as a Christian does, he support it. He said he doesn't have a problem with it, maybe 1,000 years ago, but not now. He asked me what I thought. I told him that when I was active in the church, I didn't agree with it and don't to this day. He said that was interesting. So, this gets me to my conundrum. I honestly don't know what to do about the holidays. Tickets have been purchased and plans been made. Going through with it is going to be awkward for me at best. I'm honestly shocked and sickened. Thanks for listening. I needed to vent, although at this point I need a really strong drink. Any advice or thoughts? Signed, Eric. Okay, first off, Eric, I can't advise you as to what to do about your holiday plans. It's your family, you know them, I don't, no way I'm getting in the middle here in a specific case. The closest thing to advice I can give you is, if you do go to visit them, is there going to be some kind of big blowout of a shouting match which ruins everybody's holiday, either precipitated by them or by you? If there is the aforementioned big argument and shouting match that ruins everybody's holiday, how bad will the long-term fallout be? Will it totally destroy your family relationship, and if so, do you want to maintain aforesaid family relationship at all? No advice at all from me on what is the right decision for you, because in specific cases, I don't know what's right. I simply suggest that you need to sit down and think all of this out beforehand and anticipate the consequences of whatever course you take. This gets into the whole question, which is one I've addressed very seldom down through the years, of families and how one balances racial duty with your desire, or in some cases, the necessity of maintaining some kind of relationship with your non-racial and non-political, or in some cases, hell, in many cases, with your outright hostile family. As you can imagine, I have quite a few stories to tell, including my own, which I'm not going to get into because this show and this party and this cause of Northwest Freedom is not about me, it's about you. This is a very long and complex subject about which whole novels could be written, and someday will be, and multiple episodes of Radio Free Northwest could be produced. Okay, time for one of my Grandpa Simpson moments. Wait for it. I, myself, have over 40 years of personal experience with this very complex and upsetting phenomenon.
40 years, sonny!
So I think I'm somewhat qualified to speak. Let me give you a very basic and very incomplete rundown on what I've observed about nationalists and their family relations. Bare bones, Cliff Notes version. First off, there are white nationalists who have good or at least rational relations with their families or with certain members of those families. It does happen. In my experience, not in the majority of cases, but it does happen. Some of us have a kind of guarded neutrality arrangement, especially in cases where, for whatever reason, there has to be some kind of family contact and interaction, as in legal child custody issues. We show up on all the birthdays and holidays with carefully selected non-controversial presents for any children involved, so you're not accused of trying to propagandize or proselytize the kids. That's always a minefield. They're convinced that wicked evil racism is catching, because that's what they're conditioned to think by the media, that racism is taught rather than learned from observation, and that the only way to keep their children from catching it and becoming pariahs and outcasts themselves is to ostracize you and keep you away from the kiddies before you corrupt their pure little minds with your horrible thoughts. If I was talking about my own personal experiences, I could really lay some stories on you in that regard. Yeah, I know and you know that so-called racism and anti-Semitism in this day and age generally aren't produced in young people by contact with wicked, evil, racist adults. This is because the adults who still hold the traditional views on these matters are by now so old and out of it, and because the middle-aged white males are so badly beaten down and frightened that the lawyers and other bad men will come and take their stuff. They don't dare try to influence the young. Almost all the younger white nationalists I know are self-taught, and they were converted or persuaded to be racists by black behavior and by being persecuted and oppressed by America and political correctness. These racial ideas and reactions are today produced by daily enforced contact with niggers and Jews and third world immigrants, not because daddy or grandpa sat you down on his knee and told you all about the black folks. But the official version is that whatever we've allegedly got is contagious, and we walk around trying to put bad thoughts in little kiddies' heads, so there is always a kind of tension and a tacit understanding that certain topics are not to be mentioned around the dinner table when we are visiting with family. Now, if you are able to obtain this kind of a relationship with your parents or siblings or ex-spouse with whom you share child custody or whatever, respect it, maintain it, and just be quiet in the face of all the many provocations you will experience. That kind of relationship should be sustained as long as possible, because quite frankly, that's usually as good as it gets. Remember, as annoying as it is to put up with the little needlings and baitings and microaggressions, as the Democrats call it, it could be a lot worse. Bear in mind that the adults are probably looking for any excuse to cut you off from contact with the children. And if you can manage it, that contact needs to be maintained because when the time comes that they are old enough to understand, then you really do, in fact, need to be able to access them and try to explain to them the nature of the world they're growing up in because most likely no one else will. You don't want these kids wandering out into the political and racial toilet of Democratic America on their own and without guidance. That's how Dylan roofs are made. Now, the next thing you need to bear in mind is that from their point of view, their attempts to expel you or freeze you out or at least limit your access to the family circle makes a certain kind of horrible sense. They may hate you for being what you are, but try to understand that they are also afraid of you as well. In the first place, they're afraid of you to at least some degree because they think you may go crazy with a gun and kill them all under the Christmas tree, which is what they have been told that we are like, all of us. Now, that is the image of us that the liberal media project, what they've deliberately installed in people's minds, and I have to admit that turkeys like Dylan Roof don't do much to break that stereotype. But mostly, they're afraid of you because they understand the danger that you represent to them, to the family, and to their well-being in this increasingly dangerous and collapsing society. Now, let's be honest, guys. To a large extent, they're right. The ultimate threat in democratic America is that someone who is associated with political incorrectness or critical thinking, even by association, will lose what they have. That someone will impose this society's ultimate penalty. They will come to your house and take your stuff. Your family are afraid not just for their material goods, but for their jobs, which is how most white people define themselves. They're afraid for their standing in the herd. They're afraid for their self-perceived identity and everything that makes life worth living to the typical pale white herd animal. There is an old saying that if you catch a monkey and paint him green and turn him loose back into the jungle, the other monkeys will kill him for being different. You guys know that because we're all green monkeys, so to speak, and our families are terrified that if we are allowed to hang around, we will slop some of that green paint of guilt by association onto them and cause the other monkeys at the office or the country club or the PTA to turn on them. And they're correct. In the current political climate of paranoia and dictatorship, that very thing might happen in a dozen different ways. The fact is that by being different in the one way that people of our skin color are not allowed to be different, you do represent a threat to them and to their material and emotional well-being. And they're taking multiple risks every time you drop by the house or sit down at the Thanksgiving table. Make no mistake, this society has ways of dealing with stroppy white boys whose minds are not properly under control. Those FBI and DHS snakes aren't sitting there in their cubicles listening to this podcast for nothing. As in all totalitarian third world dictatorships, in Obama's America, guilt by association is a very real possibility. And your relatives are not being unreasonable in their fear that if they do not publicly disavow and disown you, if they allow their son or brother or father to come over for Christmas dinner or stop by for a cookout in the summer, then one day the knock will come on their door. When you become a white nationalist, even if you're not active with any particular group, even if you just play around on Stormfront or whatever, you are leaving the herd. And whether you fully realize it or not, you can never again be part of the world that your family and other loved ones inhabit. Once you realize the enormity of it all, once it hits you that race is real and it's the central factor in everything that is going on around you, once you understand that it's the Jews, stupid, once you know, then you can't not know. You can't unring the bell, and unless and until the members of your family come to that epiphany themselves, you are forever separated from them, no matter how many Thanksgivings or Christmases you get invited to. Once you unplug yourself from the television set and the mainstream media websites, you can't ever plug yourself back in. Those of you who have tried it can confirm this. Would it surprise you to learn that I myself have tried it a time or two in the past 40 years? I did. Didn't last very long. If nothing else, when you finish watching some dumbass movie or TV show and the end credits roll and you see all those Jewish names, the knowledge that you possess, which so few others among us know, hits you like a ton of bricks. Some of you are able to come to an accommodation with that knowledge in exchange for a partial readmission back into the fringes of the Great Pale Herd, back into the world of family, of social acceptance, of the material things with which Obama's America still rewards conformity. You lock it away in your minds, guarding your tongue and scanning every word that comes out of your mouth lest you betray yourself to those around you, and alert the system in some way that your mind is not fully under control. But the fact remains that you know, and one way or another, your family and other significant others will know that you know. And for the rest of your life, even if you do more or less surrender on the surface, there will always be the funny little looks they give you when they think you're not watching. In my considered opinion, one of the worst things you can do if you are still allowed any contact with family and old friends is to try and argue and debate and convince these muggles through reason. And my conclusion after many years of observing our little slice of life is that white people, most of them, cannot be convinced of the truth through reason or research or logical argument, especially white people born after about 1980 who have never been taught how to think, only how to feel, who have been conditioned to receive the Zionist programming into their minds but never how to write their own code, so to speak. My advice? Don't try to win your family over with argument. Let the niggers convince them through some act of horrific violence. Let Obamacare convince them when they get their hours at work cut down to 29.5 hours a week because their employer can't afford to deal with the whole hideous healthcare thing, or else they just don't want to mess with it. Let unemployment devastate them and student loans crush them and their children under years of staggering debt so they can't even start their lives until they're 35 or 36, if they're lucky. I've always had a theory that what will eventually push most white people over the edge will not be the crime of the economic wasteland or the arrogance and cruelty of the dictatorship, but the little stuff, the petty PC, the microaggressions, if you will. Let what they see in the local Walmart when they go in to buy something convince them. It's the petty stuff that'll do it, most likely, like not being able to go into a store and just pick up a couple of items without having to spend 15 minutes standing in the checkout line behind weird foreigners of various kinds who shouldn't be here at all. Let them hear the constant booga 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 and the chattering of Spanish and Chinese and Tagalog all around them so that it drives them slowly around the twist. Eventually, as things get worse, and oh boy, are they going to get worse, eventually some little straw will finally break the camel's back. Now, I'm going to break my original resolve against talking about me personally because there's something in my own experience that might be relevant because I suspect it's something that a lot of you have had to deal with in one form or another. My own family's policy was always at least consistent. From the moment I came out to them, pardon the expression, as a National Socialist, my father laid down the party line, again, pardon the expression, and it was always pretty much adhered to from that day to this. Harold was insane. Period, end of story, and that's all there was to it. I was raving mad, and when they were forced to deal with my activities, as they were compelled to do on occasion during the first 15 years or so after that, everything was to conform to the primary narrative of my alleged insanity. All contact with me was to be carried out within a set of protocols, I suppose you'd call them, designed by my father, based on the premise that I was a gibbering lunatic. I was not a son, or a brother, or later on a husband and father. I was a problem, with a capital P, and the objective, insofar as possible, was to relegate me to a state of non-existence. Now, as it happened, there were times when things didn't quite work out that way. My father's protocols were often more honored in the breach than in the observance, so to speak, and down through the years, there was a lot more contact and interaction than met with his approval, especially when my ex-wife and my children entered the picture. It cost him a lot of time and effort and money to maintain that official narrative. For example, when my children came along, an entire structure of mendacity had to be erected in which they were to be raised, which would explain to them their existence and my absence, while still conforming to the overall narrative, and which necessitated not just my being insane, I had to be transformed into a kind of demonic prince of darkness, kind of cartoonish supervillain. Now, my case was not typical of most, to be sure. For one thing, my family situation was always bizarre. There was a lot of money involved, and money always brings out the worst in Americans. Imagine, if you will, a kind of combination of The Simpsons and The Borgias with plot lines from Dallas and American Horror Story, and you'll have some idea of what it was like. That was before I broke away and became a National Socialist. But I imagine that many of you have come up against this same problem. The official family narrative being that poor brother John has simply lost his marbles to think and do such things, and therefore it's just one of those inexplicable tragedies that families have to deal with. Nobody's really at fault, not the family, and certainly not America itself. Oh, no, no, no. America could never have driven poor little sweet Johnny off the deep end and made him a wicked, evil, racist, and anti-Semite. There couldn't possibly be any kind of objective reason for any of it. Oh, no, 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 no. Not in the greatest and most exceptional country in the world, yada, yada, yada. Now, if your family's Christian, maybe they'll just come up with an even simpler explanation. The devil made you do it. Now, this attitude in one form or another is very common among Muggle families who have a son or a daughter or a brother or a husband go white nationalist. It's a form of mental and emotional defense mechanism which is necessary to block out the contagion, so to speak, to make sure that the family unit survives as part of the herd, to make sure that the very idea that there could be a rational and understandable cause for one of us coming to believe what we believe is inadmissible for all time. Brother John is mentally ill, period, end of story. Just one of those things like cancer or leprosy, move along, nothing to see here. I know this attitude can drive you crazy, but you must never waste your time trying to argue with your relatives over it or change their minds. It's one of those discussions that generates heat rather than light, and it never works. They just get hysterical and flee the room, sometimes literally, rather than try and wrap their minds around anything that contradicts the primary narrative that you are insane. The basis of it is that you are wrong, period. Wrong about everything and never, never right about anything. You're just plain nuts. Because, you see, once they concede that you might just be right about something, some small and inconsequential thing, then the parameters shift and it becomes a matter of what you are right about and what you're wrong about. And if you're right about that one small thing, then in theory at least, the possibility exists that you might be right about other, bigger, more important things, and that cannot, must not be. Because if you are right about anything at all, and especially if you are right about the larger issues, then the very foundation of these people's lives and their worlds will crumble beneath their feet and the abyss will open up before them. That cannot and must not be allowed. Okay, I know I'm rambling and this probably doesn't make any sense. Long story short, Eric and the rest of you, unless you make the decision to leave your past completely behind, if you want to try and maintain some kind of contact with your Muggle relatives, don't try to argue with them or convert them. When they make stupid statements, just ignore it and let them go their own way until Hillary Clinton drops a house on their head and they realize they're not in Kansas anymore. And their little dog, too. Well, for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.